Judge Boggs, members of this esteemed panel and Philadelphia Society, I thank you for your invitation to speak this morning. Before I begin, I feel compelled to relate a story from Mr. Jefferson's University, University of Virginia, where I direct the Critical Incident Analysis Group and have served under Ed Meese, who was co-chair at the time. Students at the university are an integral part of our work, and at times we convene groups to meet about analyzing critical incidents. I emphasize to our students that participants in our meetings have significant stature. Well, one 19-year-old first-year biochemistry student at the University of Virginia assisted us in our meeting in 2005, and he performed very well. But 2 weeks later, he knocked on my door, and his eyes were wide with astonishment. As he told me that he had been watching the game show Jeopardy the night before. As you know, the Jeopardy program provides the answer, and the contestant then must come up with the correct question. The student told me that as he was eating his soup during the final Jeopardy question, he saw a contestant raise a card with the written question, "Who is Ed Meese?" The student said, "I know that you told me that these meeting participants are important people, but I had no idea that one of them would actually be the answer in Final Jeopardy." He said, "You don't get to be the Final Jeopardy answer unless you are a really big deal." Well, Edwin Meese has spent his life providing answers for all who revere the Constitution, and I'm sure that no one in this room will ever ask the question, "Who is Ed Meese?" So, on this fall football Saturday, one of those questions deals with the federal government's obligation to the playing field of federalism, where state government has the constitutional authority for most policing power, and in my view, must retain that power to call plays from the field. I'm a physician and not an attorney, but over the years I've discussed this issue with Ed Meese, and so I feel I stand on firm ground when I say that the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of the national government can serve states well in the very limited role of convening groups in order to better understand emerging threats to criminal justice. In certain cases, when expertise is convened, states have an opportunity to communicate, coordinate, and when necessary, collaborate. Let me be clear that this convening role should have the same effect that stadium lights have as evening comes to the football field. Properly operated lights can extend the vision and therefore the creative opportunities for states as they engage on the civil and criminal fields of play. Here at the Peabody Hotel, we encounter lots of ducks. The issue today, though, is to shed light on swans rather than ducks, black swans, in fact. A black swan event is defined as being a high-impact, hard-to-predict and rare event, but unfortunately in our increasingly wireless yet connected society, the potential for these black swan events has increased. Now, fortunately, the opportunity for information sharing to connect the dots has also increased, but how do you connect dots in Indiana when one exists in Colorado and the other in Georgia? How can Indiana learn from the black swan events in those states before they occur in its own state? In certain respects, the federal government has an advantage due to the vantage point that it occupies. As issues related to crime and terrorism globalize, enhanced communication is needed among states and jurisdictions to meet challenges brought by modern technology. This federal opportunity, and indeed its obligation, to maintain states' abilities to perform their duties is critical. In my view, it has an opportunity, if not an obligation, to convene state and local agencies. In its ability to convene, the federal government can play an important role, and I'd like to provide three examples of convening ability within the executive, legislative, and judicial branches that I've been involved in. I should also say to this group that the cost of these examples to the taxpayer was negligible. Had it been otherwise, it would place federalism in jeopardy by engaging in the price is right or let's make a deal. And that is certainly not what I'm advocating. And that is also not what Ed Meese would advocate. Within weeks of the Columbine shooting in 1999, I was authorized by the FBI to convene a symposium on school shooting. through my role as the conflict resolution specialist for the FBI. And in short order, the FBI brought together representatives from 19 different schools in the U.S. who had experienced school shootings. This included principals, teachers who had disarmed students, behavioral scientists, and others with direct expertise. Although the schools were involved in litigation that in some cases were just months old, we kept the press away so that those directly involved could share their experiences and learn from each other. The discussions and publication that resulted from our school shooter symposium illustrate a singular strength inherent in the federal government in that it can authoritatively convene disparate groups on short order. There are times when information sharing based on isolated incidents can be very beneficial, and by convening, it provides an opportunity for states and localities to understand what is transpiring in other places. This is an obligation that the federal government has to allow states to do their jobs, but not necessarily to dictate how to do their jobs. By convening, the role of the state is not threatened, but rather is enhanced. One problem we identified in our work on this topic relates to how schools approach threats and can also be applied analogously to the relationship between the federal government and states. In the report, we emphasize that all threats are not created equal. However, all threats should be assessed in a timely manner, and decisions regarding how they are handled must be done quickly. In today's climate, some schools tend to adopt a one-size-fits-all approach to any mention of violence. The response to every threat is the same, regardless of its credibility or the likelihood that it will be carried out. In the shock wave of school shootings, this reaction may be understandable, but it is exaggerated and perhaps dangerous, leading to potential underestimation of serious threats and overreaction to less serious ones, and unfairly punishing or stigmatizing students who are, in fact, not dangerous. The FBI isn't the sole executive branch convener for criminal justice issues, of course. I should also add that the Secret Service's work on the Safe School Initiative and their report in May of 2002 added a great deal of research, a great deal to this research landscape. So in anticipation of future black swan events, states should have the ability to easily access expertise derived from events that have occurred across the nation, and the federal government can facilitate such exchanges. A second example of the importance of federal-level coordination can be found via the legislative branch. In 2006, I testified before the U.S. Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs as part of a panel looking at the issue of radicalization and formation of terrorist cells in U.S. prisons. Those issues still resonate today. Prison systems are administered, as you know, at the federal, state, and local levels, and while there are good reasons to have a decentralized prison system, our prisons have not adapted to share information with other facilities and agencies. At the time of my Senate testimony, 3,500 jails were city or county-operated facilities, and some of those were really quite huge, dwarfing many prisons in size. For example, more than 25 jails house more than 3,000 inmates each. It's not our general conception of a jail, but these are facilities that that are challenging, to say the least. While most prisons and jail systems are separate, some states combine their jail and prison systems under state departments of corrections. And of course, in the era of privatization, more private companies are running prisons. State governments operate nearly 1,000 facilities. Private companies run more than 200 facilities. At least that was the number at the time of my testimony. It's increased at this point. Coordination and collaboration between publicly and privately managed facilities has not been achieved, however, and presents a serious problem in the national struggle against radicalization and terrorism. We currently lack the necessary data to determine both the extent and patterns of radical religious recruitment for incarcerated prisoners and released inmates. Even if a religious provider is removed from one facility, that provider can simply apply to enter into a prison in another state. Now, the issue is that if an event occurs, a black swan event occurs, expecting the Joint Terrorism Task Force to be the primary force for dealing with this complex problem is like expecting emergency rooms to provide all medical care. Proactive, integrated intelligence sharing systems are critical to identify dots before they become plots. It's true that the vast majority of persons incarcerated in this country are within our state correctional systems. They are a major concern because of the great variability in prison systems, populations, and approaches to this recent phenomenon. So how do we retain the independence of state prisons while also facilitating better communication in order to detect and prevent black swan events? I would not advocate homogeneity in state prison systems, as that would be antithetical to federalism and the benefits, the great benefits that come from creative approaches that can emerge when states can call plays from the field rather than relying on the press box for policy recommendations. Last, I'd like to point out an example of the benefit of federal coordination by way of the judicial system. In July 2008, Dr. Bruce Ivins learned that he was to be indicted as the anthrax mailer in the 2001 anthrax mailing attacks, and he killed himself in order to seek answers to questions that would now not be able to be asked in court. The Department of Justice obtained a court order from Chief Judge Royce Lambert to obtain the sealed psychiatric records of Dr. Ivins. As the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit's consultant psychiatrist, I was asked to review the psychiatric records, which remained under seal. This request was based on the belief that these records might contain valuable information previously unavailable to investigators that could help investigators better understand Dr. Ivins' motivations and behavior. After receiving hundreds of pages of records dating back over three decades, I concluded that the case was so complex and significant that the review should not be conducted solely by me, but by an independent multidisciplinary panel. After a valuable conversation with Ed Meese, considerable consultation with authorities in their disciplines, I specifically proposed a panel of experts with backgrounds in psychiatry, psychology, medicine, law, and network and systems analysis. It was my expectation that I would thus be stepping away from the case. Instead, in September 2009, Chief Judge Lambert issued an order authorizing me to chair the independent panel of experts to examine the mental health issues of Dr. Bruce Ivins and what lessons can be learned from that analysis that might be useful in preventing future bioterrorism attacks. Our panel conducted a multidisciplinary review of Dr. Ivins' sealed mental health records dating back three decades. The panel was also given access to the entire investigative file. The material it examined contained numerous interviews and references regarding Dr. Ivins' family, friends, acquaintances, and colleagues. This material was often very helpful in understanding not only Dr. Ivins as an individual, but also his social and professional environment. This information had been deemed confidential during Dr. Ivins' lifetime. And indeed it was, accessible only to his medical providers and off-limits to investigators. The information remains confidential and became available to this panel only as a result of the federal court order of 2009, well after Dr. Ivins' 2008 death. These medical records, combined with FBI interviews of treating outpatient and inpatient mental health professionals, permitted the panel a more complete understanding of Dr. Ivins, his motivations, and his behaviors before, during, and after the anthrax attacks of September, October 2001. Now, this unique case study again illustrates the federal capacity to act as convener by shining a light on records that were otherwise inaccessible, even to investigators. However, I do not mean that the federal role is an obligation to blur the boundaries or take away the interest of state or local entities with regard to police powers. As an example, our report found that privacy laws and regulations did not appear to bar the government from following up with Dr. Ivins' civilian therapists and psychiatrists at the time he was hired or during the decades that ensued. After Dr. Ivins had worked at US AMRID, the Army Research Facility in Maryland, for some time, however, familiarity appears to have played a significant role in the failure of systems to operate effectively. Dr. Ivins' long tenure at US AMRID led to a degree of complacency towards him that enabled him to avoid scrutiny before and after the anthrax mailings. Our report also notes that the Department of Justice did not seek or obtain access to Dr. Ivins' comprehensive psychiatric records during its investigation of the anthrax attacks. Although federal investigators requested access to the medical records, the U.S. Attorney's Office viewed privacy law and its relationship to mental health and medical records as a significant legal barrier to obtaining them. While calling for increased scrutiny of medical and mental health records for those who work in these very special areas, scientists who work with weapons of mass destruction, our report emphasizes that the privacy of such records must be strictly protected as well, with penalties for inappropriate use or disclosure. In other words, without a federal chief judge authorizing my panel's access to these records, this sort of assessment would not have been possible. Because Dr. Ivan's records resided in multiple localities within multiple states, an absence of federal coordination would not have allowed for the records to be collected or kept so that the panel could use it in its work. In conclusion, I've looked at three examples of the convening ability in the federal government, legislative, judicial, and executive. When usual and unique critical incidents occur, and they occur frequently enough to pose significant challenges, federalism is not threatened and indeed can be enhanced when the federal government plays a modest role as moderator or convener rather than the role of arbiter or director regarding issues regarding criminal justice powers that belong to the states. When the federal government thoughtfully exercises its power to convene, the policing powers inherent in the states are maintained, retained, and even strengthened. This is not final jeopardy for federalism so long as the answers to the most challenging criminal justice questions lie in the Constitution and the powers that are invested in the states. Thank you again for this opportunity to address the group, and I look forward to the ensuing discussion.